KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It was 25 years ago that the film Eve's Bayou changed the stakes in independent film and planted the flag for women of color as directors and writers. Its writer-director Casey Lemons was here about 25 years ago talking about that movie. She's been here for a few movies in between. Her current triumph as director is Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. Casey Lemons, thank you so much for being here.
You know, it's always a pleasure.
God, you know, it's so interesting, too, because you think we think about your films. If we think about Eve's Bayou or Talk to Me or Black Nativity. And now this, at some point, they're all about an article of faith. They're all about somebody taking either leaping past everything to believe in themselves or to take a belief in others. And I want to talk to you about that, because that idea of believing, forcing yourself to believe, sometimes even against your own best instincts, which is what Eve's Bayou is, where that comes from for you as subject matter.
I think it comes from very deep in my childhood, Elvis. I mean, it's always been such a part of me, believing. I can remember when I was a little kid, I would get sick a lot and I would hallucinate, you know, and I remember thinking about what was real for a very long time. Also reflecting on my relationship with my big sister, who would spin stories a lot, and I would have to kind of figure out what the reality was, and that made its way into Eve's Bayou. But belief has always been a really big deal for me. As somebody who was a kid, I saw ghosts, and there was a very thin line in many cases between what was concretely real and what was real to me in other ways. And I think that all plays into it.
Is that why there's often this spiritual question or question about what is real and what is corporeal in the movies? Because certainly it's kind of the bedrock of I Want to Dance with Somebody, isn't it?
I think it's there in almost everything that I've done in one way or another. And this question of belief in terms of believing in yourself also, you know? Yeah, maybe that had to do with the fact that I was the only person going into entertainment and my family is kind of very academic, you know?
Yes. And for me, these movies kind of bookend each other. You know, at some point, the leap of faith has to be made, and there are naysayers surrounding the protagonists of both of these movies, aren't there? And in both these cases, these young women have to say who and what they are, and even sort of wrestling with their divided selves in both of these stories.
Yeah, I think wrestling with your divided selves is another thing that appeals to me. I'm not sure why, but certainly it was very appealing and I Want to Dance with Somebody. And I mean, I do think it had to do with the fact that I knew Whitney a little bit and, you know, she had two very kind of different sides to her and was multifaceted like many people are and like most of us are, but could lean into kind of one persona or the other, you know.
Well, but it's interesting, too, to me, and it's something I don't think we've seen in a studio film in certainly a long time, the question of what selling out means as a person of color and what a big deal that was 40 years ago when she was starting to rise and wrestling with that self. And in fact, the problem comes that she can step from one side to another with such apparent ease that really seems to sort of raise the stakes and these schisms in her personality.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for Whitney, she was in many ways musically being true to herself, you know, although I think she got more into her authentic self later, but she really was genuinely interested in all different kinds of music. And I mean, I think that that was authentic. The image was perhaps a bit manufactured, you know, but in terms of the music, I don't think she was selling out. I think she was singing what she liked. How that was used by other people, you know, that's perhaps something different. But I think for her, these were her interests. She liked all kinds of music. She liked big songs. I think she was quite devastated by the fact that people accused her of selling out.
Yeah, it's 'cause she's probably the last of the generation of people who dealt with that. I mean, and then on the other side of the coin, at the same time, if you were a hip hop artist, if you were a rapper, you celebrated selling out. You wanted that kind of success. You competed for it. So to be judged in those kind of pop terms, to me, it's so much about the sort of the war between different Black sensibilities, even of that time.
Right. I mean, it's so interesting because, as we know, there are an infinite number of ways of being Black, you know, and even being Black American. I mean, it's but yet sometimes we feel like we have to be the gatekeepers of authenticity, in quotes.
We're talking to director Casey Lemons. Her new film is Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. You can also hear this show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I feel like it's so much about what is authentic to her and what's real to her at the time, which in this way kind of makes it, again, about this, almost this sort of ghost story and putting on these things. And at some point she's almost, it feels like she's playing dress up, putting on those different wigs.
Well, I definitely think she was playing dress up. You know, Whitney was a tomboy and in many ways very comfortable in her own skin, though I think she'd been treading that line of being, you know, kind of bullied by maybe the white kids at the Catholic school or, you know, the Black kids on the basketball court, you know, which I can definitely relate to because that was some of my childhood as well. But I do think she was comfortable in her own skin and was kind of a tomboy and a round the way girl and had a side of her that was comfortably neighborhood, you know what I mean? But also had this poise that lent itself very well to her kind of alter ego self, which was, you know, the America's princess.
God, you know, Casey, talking to you, I just feel like so much of this movie is about what that smile did and how much it fooled people and how much it became a piece of armor for her.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember meeting her very clearly. I wrote 2 screenplays for her, and I can remember that she was, you know, she was silly. She could be goofy. She could laugh at herself, but it was a very different person, you know, a person perhaps weary and, you know, troubled that you definitely didn't see when she was putting on that glam smile and, you know, the twinkle in her eyes always.
Gosh, I mean, I think it's such a complex movie because it's about the war for Black sensibility and what you were allowed to say and be at that point. I can't watch the movie not think about what Madonna was able to do and how many different guys that she was able to play with, whereas Whitney was trapped in this thing in some ways.
Yeah, and it's complicated because it was definitely being white friendly, you know, to cross over to a broad audience. I mean, that was definitely part of it when you talk about what could be accused of selling out, but that wasn't musical, that wasn't the image, you know. For the Black audience, we're constantly searching for what's ours, you know, what we claim, what belongs to us. And, you know it kind of, we feel like we know it when we see it, and it can make us at times perhaps narrow-minded. And I think at that time, particularly like you're saying, at that time it was really like, okay, well, it's not identifiably R&B, you know, therefore is she selling out? It's not Black enough.
I just find myself thinking in so many ways back to Eve's Bayou, which in some ways reminded me of like an old Douglas Sirk movie and some imitation of life where the emotions are so big. And in fact, the emotional turns feel like characters in and of themselves in this movie.
Yeah, you know, I've always liked big emotions. It's so funny because, you know, I admire restrained movies, but that's just not me. I mean, I tend to kind of go for the big emotions.
It's so interesting because I feel like to take melodrama seriously is not something a lot of directors do. And given the sort of the operatic sort of size of the conflicts and as you were talking about the beginning in your own life, is that what made you comfortable from the outset being able to stage such big things, such big emotional stakes?
You know, maybe it is if we go back to Eve's Bayou, maybe it is because my parents were, I was the afterthought by many, many years.
Oh, really?
And probably an accident. Yeah. In my family and my parents had ceased to get along, if they ever did, way before I was born. And they fought a lot when I was a kid. And so I do think that makes its way into that kind of very dramatic arguments that they would have makes its way into my work sometimes. But like I tell my students, you know, art comes out of me a certain way. It has nothing to do with the types of movies I admire, all kinds of movies, but art comes out of me a certain way, and it comes out big with big emotions.
I'm trying to talk about this movie without giving too much away. I mean, we know how this, her life ends, Whitney Houston, but I marvel at the sort of the big steps the movie takes and the size of the scenes. And I mean, from the outset, it's big. I mean, because in addition to the incredible Naomi in the lead, you've also got Tamara Tooney and Clark Peters as her parents. So these are actors who can basically sort of claim territory and let us know where they stand. And it takes me back to East Bayou again, because at some point there's so many people fighting for a part of her soul in the same way they were for the protagonist of East Bayou.
Yeah, and in many ways, both of those movies are family dramas, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, one of the things that attracted me to I Want to Dance with Somebody is that it has a family drama aspect.
Whitney is almost the audience surrogate, because everybody in the movie thinks they know her and are sort of talking about her as if they know her and sort of taking claim of her in some way that kind of shows that they're only seeing the part that gives them a chance to sort of be opportunistic about her.
Yeah, it's funny because we do that with celebrity, right? Like, you know, when I was a young actress in New York, I felt like I knew her, you know. But to have from your own family, I think there's something interesting that happens when you are the business of your entire family. And they're very invested in the whatever that image is, you know. When I met John Houston, I met Whitney and John, her dad, at the same time. And I was very taken aback, kind of shook by my meeting with John Houston, because he talked about the brand. And it was the first time, I guess, I'd been in a personal conversation that dealt with that, where his daughter, you know, had just left the room and he's talking about the brand, you know. And I thought that was, I don't know, a little spooky.
In so many ways, people are not talking about her as a person, but as a perception. It's almost like the world has treated her as a schizophrenic rather than her being one. And that's what I find so interesting about the movie.
Well, I think that there's no question that she was loved. And I look at these as love relationships by her parents. And certainly, you know, Robin and Bobby and Clive and the people around her, they loved her. But there was this duality of her being the family business and the brand being something part of her, but separate from her, that was interesting, you know? I mean, when I met John Houston, he said, I want her to be Barbie. And that really freaked me out. I'm like, this Black woman that I just met, who has a lot on her shoulders and perhaps, you know, could use some support, and you want her to be Barbie. You know, it was weird. And it shook me up, I gotta say. And I thought about it for a very long time. And when I was approached about the film, and I realized that John Houston would be a character and that kind of relationship would be a big part of the story, I was very intrigued.
How did you react when he said that to you? What did you say?
I don't know what I said. He attached it to the next thought, which was he wanted me to write another. I came to pitch her a movie, and I think he was saying, well, I don't know if we're going to do that movie you just pitched us, but there's a movie I'd like you to write. And then in that conversation someplace quickly slipped in, you know, I want her to be Barbie, and talked about the brand. I can't remember. I remember kind of wanting to get away from him. he was quite charming, but it definitely shook me.
Everybody trying to marry their perception of her to the way she should be presented. And because she was, in that way, in celebrity does that thing to people, with everybody wants to say, I know this person best and they are this. And there is a lot of that kind of sort of summarization of her in real time in the movie.
I do think that there was a huge investment in this image and thinking that that was the way to, you know, that was the way she was going to make it, that was very important, you know, for her. And it was the ideal, you know, in some ways, a white plastic doll, you know, Barbie was an ideal.
We're going to peel back the shrink wrap with my guest, Casey Lemons. Her new film as director is Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. It's a treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is director Casey Lemon. She's been away way too long. Her first time here goes back to almost basically the beginning of the show for her film East Bayou 25 years ago, a landmark moment in independent film. Her recent film is also a landmark moment, and I think Black drama and Black melodrama and also Black historical drama. It's the film Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. Again, I don't want to give too much away, but what is a big scene in so many romance movies, the proposal scene between Whitney and Bobby Brown is, I think, one of the best things you've ever staged, just because there's so much going on in it. And as we're it's all these things we're talking about, we're not sure if we want to laugh or be horrified by it.
Well, I think a little of both, you know.
I think a lot of both.
Yeah. I certainly laugh when I watch it, I got to tell you.
Do you? Okay. Were you laughing as you were staging it?
Absolutely. Ashton's Bobby made me laugh and cringe and all the kind of good stuff, you know, that you want. But I also think that scene was quite well written, and I staged it completely different than the way it was written, though, and the staging very much helped.
You're playing with movie conventions about that kind of thing, which is the fun of it. But it's also, we're kind of aware that in some ways that Ashton, who we all know from Moonlight, is the kind of guy that Bobby Brown thinks, yeah, that's what I look like, probably. Mm-hmm. So there's all this awareness, there are all these layers of it, but also, too, the fact that, again, he's not really talking to her. And there's so much of that in the movie that plays in these ways where we're aware of all the possibilities, or all the possibilities seem open to us. It's an extraordinary moment in a movie that's full of sort of moments that are really pitched kind of high. And it's so delicate. So I want you to talk about it, because if it goes one way, it is comedy rather than being a moment that has comic implications.
The wonderful thing about actors is that they're wrestling with all those things, you know, and making choices and yet playing it like it's never been played before. And I love that, because when we would rehearse it, Naomi would laugh, you know. She'd laugh also at the emotion that she was having of just like being so angry, you know. And it was quite delightful. I love playing those kind of scenes with actors. I really enjoy that alchemy that happens in the moment where you know something's, you know, the lines and you know what's going to happen in the scene, and you've even rehearsed the scene, and yet it's happening right there in real time. And I do think that's it's just a great scene, because it's happening in real time and you're watching her process this, you know, this information, and you're watching him process, you know, he needed to get something off his chest, and he does.
We should say Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody, it's at this point available only in theaters, and this is where it should be seen. In fact, I was sent a link and I didn't get a chance to exercise in time, so I paid my money and went to see it in the movie theater. And I want to say, first of all, as a piece of directing, that scene is really like an acting exercise, where what's underneath the scene is really against what's being said at the time. And to get the chance to see actors of color doing something this complex, that's almost farcical, but there's so much at stake in the moment that it's farcical only because it's surreal. I mean, it's a really beautiful piece of directing, Casey.
Thank you so much. I really do love comedy, and farce always has to have tragedy, right? And pain for the characters. Otherwise, it doesn't work. You know, it's got to be real and painful in some ways and very truthful in order to be played right.
Well, talk to me about meeting Naomi for the first time and making your decision about casting her as Whitney, because there's this thing about the character where in different rooms, she's a different person. And it's about her deciding how much of her guard she's going to let down, but also just sort of playing to the perception of the person who's talking to her, because it's easier than having a fight about that. So she's balancing a lot of things in playing Whitney. So talk about finding somebody who could really do all of those things from scene to scene, and often in the same scene.
So I came onto the movie quite late, actually. I came on about halfway through prep, which was its own story. But she had been cast before I would even talk to them. the producers in a serious way. I said, I need to see her screen test because I know they had gone on this big search. And I'm like, I can't entertain it until I see who you've cast. And they sent me your screen test. And I was like, okay, this is going to work. She's phenomenal. And that was before she'd gone through this whole physical transformation and months and months of prep and everything like that. So when I met Naomi, she was most of the way through her physical transformation and had been really working on the character for quite a long time. But I got to tell you, I related to Naomi on a personal level. I just dug her. I just really love the person that she is. But there's something about her that reminds me of Whitney. And I've been trying to articulate this. She's got this dignity and this elegance that is almost regal, and yet she's real regular Black chick. You know, she's there. There's something about her that's real normal and accessible and comfortable with who she is. And those two things working together and kind of against each other, I really related to the way that I could relate to Whitney. You know what I mean? But I think she's a phenomenal person and a phenomenal artist. And her seriousness and her approach to the character and to the material and to the vast amount that she would have to learn, you know, every breath of a song and movement of a song. And that's Naomi. That's just the artist that she is. She's quite phenomenal.
There's something sort of lithe about her as an actor that really hits that thing that Whitney does, except when Whitney would sing and didn't quite know what to do with her arms, which is a really fascinating thing. As somebody who moved so well, when she would walk through a video, you thought, the first time you see her, in fact, in Saving All My Love for You, you think she's an actor because she's so natural just moving through when she's not singing. And when she sings, that peculiar thing that happened, that, again, could be a sketch thing, that Naomi plays so well. I mean, that she could encompass all of those contradictions must have thrilled you.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was an amazing experience with all of the actors. I loved them. They dug deep and gave everything. And Naomi blew me away every day, like every day. I mean, it's just a joy to direct her.
I find myself thinking back to, you know, Talk to Me Too, and that idea of what being around a performer does to people, except in this movie, in some way, everybody's kind of a performer. Like, everybody takes up as much space as she does. So that thing we were talking about in the first half, which is sort of fighting for a place in the room. And this is, I think, where her understanding of character, Naomi's understanding of character, comes into play. And that in some ways, she has to decide how much of that elegance or that boyish quality, that tomboy quality, she wants to show to people. We really see it with Stanley doing Clive, because it's an actor doing a performance of somebody who's playing a kingpin. So, I mean, the levels of sort of self-deception and offering up. I mean, that's more great stuff to me, too. I mean, there's so much about balance and people being attuned and the size, this sort of epic scale of people being in these rooms, and everybody, with the exception of Robin almost, everybody in the room with her wants to make an entrance and have an impact. And that's part of the comedy, too, of this, at least to me, or the fun of watching it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Well, you look at her mother's a performer. So Sissy is a performer, you know, used to taking stage and has a big personality. And of course, Bobby's a performer, used to taking stage and has a big personality. And then her father is this big persona, you know, and Clive is this big persona. And really, Robin is just being Robin, just like kind of an authentic person.
Although it does feel kind of like play acting in some way, like kids playing and being adults, or what they thought the relationship would be. But it feels like there's an honesty in it. You know, they're just trying things on rather than Whitney sort of assuming these persona. And again, I don't know if Stanley was already in the movie when you came on, but his playing Clive's vanity is really kind of beautiful.
Yeah, I love it so much. No, I cast everyone, but, you know, to a great extent, except for Naomi. I think Bria was cast, who plays Bobby Christina as a teenager. But other than that, I cast them. And Ashton had done a screen test that I had seen. But other than that, I cast everyone.
Well, talk about finding your Robin for this, because, again, that's where the movie becomes something really intimate. Tonally, you do so much with this. And that must have been part of the, I guess, sort of the fun of it, but also the challenge of it, too, to make that stuff seem really natural. I mean, I was thinking back to the stuff you did with Journey Smollett in East Bayou, where she feels like, you know, somebody's sort of being born in front of the camera. And those scenes with Whitney and Robin feel that way, too, of they're being born in front of the camera.
Yeah, it's so interesting because Nafisa is a wonderful talent. I didn't really know her. We're doing everything on Zoom and had this Zoom audition, which I saw. And I was like, well, I like this woman. I really like her. And then brought her back and she did a chemistry read with Naomi and they blew me away. It's like, oh, okay. That's that magic thing that kind of makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck, which is chemistry. And when you have that between actors, that's like, that's the gold. And they had such incredible chemistry. But I didn't really know Nafisa. And for all I knew, she was kind of like Robin, but she's nothing like that character. And she's just so wonderful as an actor. And just they just lit up the screen whenever they were together. And there was, like you said, a playfulness and just an innocence about their relationship that I loved, and an honesty.
It really is the stuff when they're together, like two kids in the backyard. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of watching from the window. The movie, because there's so much going on in it, those are the moments of respite. As you were saying, seeing her for the first time on Zoom, how do you, I mean, that's clearly how attuned you are to actors, because I don't know how you would see that kind of quality in somebody, not even being in the room with them.
Well, it's really interesting because I'll never forget the first time I saw Don Cheadle and Chiwetel Ejiofor do a scene together in the same room. It was like the hair stood up on the back of my neck, and it was Chiwetel's audition. And it was that lightning in a bottle, magical alchemy chemistry. And you're like, okay, this is the combination that's going to work. And doing auditions on Zoom, you would think you're at a tremendous disadvantage, but actually you can have chemistry over Zoom. I saw it over and over again.
Really?
Yeah, with Tooney and Naomi, definitely. And with Ashton and Naomi, definitely. And with Nafisa and Naomi, absolutely. It's this wonderful thing that great actors can bring, but also there's something very real about it. There's something very real about actors having chemistry or not having chemistry. And in this case, I got lucky with the chemistry.
My guest, who doesn't do the show nearly enough, so I guess that means she needs to make more movies, is Casey Lemons. Her new film as director is Whitney Houston. I Want to Dance with Somebody. It's a pleasure having you here, Casey. Thanks so much for doing this.
It's my pleasure.
The return to the show of director Casey Lemons, who's also returning to making movies with the biopic Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody, only in theaters. I love saying that. There's much to love, I'm told, on past episodes of the show. Find them at kcrw.com/thetreatment. I'm shameless. Love us all around us. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
How you learn how to write comics? By editing other people and starting your career in the movie business and then moving over to comics. My guest, Sandy King Carpenter of Storm King Comics, which is now what, 11 years old?
10.
10, okay.
It'll be 10 in May.
A company that was started because basically she had too many ideas for the movies. And so rather than wait for these things to get made and to wait for the taste of executives to catch up with this kind of stuff that they do there, she decided to launch a comics company. And there's so much terrific stuff. And clearly, you're both a great editor and writer. Buried Deep made me laugh so hard. Your story, Buried Deep. Talk about what got you in comics. You tell me before we got started, there is a, I'm not going to say IP, a project that you were working on with John Carpenter, Asylum. And you guys wanted to go pitch that out, right?
Yeah, well, basically, we had something with Thomas Ian Griffith and John and I.
Who you worked with on Vampires.
Right. And he's a great writer, a real smart guy. And he'd brought over an idea. And then he and John and I worked up something for a television show. And this was a long time ago when they used to say everything was too dark. This was pre-Breaking Bad days. So we're at the studio that says they want to do it. And it turned into the regular conversations where, couldn't it be a sleepy little street on the East Coast? And I said, no, we're not going to North Carolina, so you can go non-union. And the city of Los Angeles was a character in the movie because during our fire seasons in Santa Ana winds, it looks like hell on earth. And it was about Satan coming through in the City of Angels as a joke on God. It just turned into this whole thing. They said, well, oh, it's not like we're matching to a graphic novel or anything. And I went, yeah, actually, it is. And I got kicked by a 6'5" vampire next to me under the table. And on the other side, an agent. And we walk out. And they said, what was that all about? And I said, we're doing a comic book. Because we always have all this art done for presentations when it's movies and television shows and things. I said, this is a visual thing that's really important. And I go home and John says, so how'd it go? I said, great, we're doing a comic book. He said, what do we know about comics? I said, absolutely nothing. We'll learn.
And you could easily have done something where you just published like a one-off to claim ownership of the intellectual property, but you decided you want to go into this business.
Well, a big mistake happened. We won awards and I grew famous.
I'm so sorry. That's so awful.
You know, I never win awards. And so I went, okay, this is really cool. Not only that, it was fun. And I had originally come from animation, so I dug the process.
Oh, so you were familiar with that kind of graphic storyboarding that's basically like doing panels for comics anyway.
Well, I got the whole level of pencils, inks, color, that kind of thing. Literally, I'm kind of an idiot. So, you know, when I got the whole comic put together, I realized I didn't know how to deliver it. There was a learning curve. You know, it's like people who say, I can make movies, I've seen lots of them. But I was fortunate in that there were great people like Bruce Jones, like Steve Niles, like Tim Bradstreet, who we knew from crossing worlds with them because...
And longtime veterans and really accomplished writers and artists. Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, so they were very generous with their advice, very forthcoming, and all wind up working for me now.
I was thinking about that great introduction to Sour Candy, to Redhead and Sour Candy, as a matter of fact. The authors are all, I can't believe I'm writing comics for these people, and then tell a story. But also in these stories, we can see the influence of the movies that you worked on with John on their work. And you read Sour Candy, you can't not see In the Mouth of Madness in it.
Mm-hmm.
But also it's begging to be made into a movie itself because it's got enough life in it. And it's also the writer talking in his introduction about how losing his daughter to leukemia led him to sort of live out this other kind of fiction life in this story.
Yeah, Dwayne Swierczynski, that was Redhead, he wanted to feel like in some way his daughter Evie, there was a way for her to be empowered supernaturally. that she was able to fight where she really couldn't. So I think that one of the things that my comic company does is I really trust artists to do their best work if I don't mess with them, because I think that's the artistic spirit. And when I edit, it's to see whether they need one more input to do what they intended. Like sometimes I'll read something and go, you know, you're almost there, but what if? And try and be supportive, not take away what they're doing.
Clearly, my guest, who is not an idiot by any means, is Sandy King Carpenter, the founder of Storm King Comics, now celebrating its 10th anniversary. But what I like so much about these books is they all so stylistically different. I was reading and one that I really loved, Stanley's Ghosts, which has a feel of old Warner Brothers cartoons in terms of the art and the immediacy of like seeing the character and knowing just from the way their eyes look, the way their eyes have been drawn, who and what they are, but also that there is a kind of a fairy tale aspect to it as well. And in so many of the stories, in fact, there's a kind of a fairy tale, almost a fable-like. They feel in some ways like they were inspired by comics, but they moved into other kind of literary areas. Do you know what I mean?
Well, with the kids' books, Storm Kids, I wanted things that were all age appropriate, so that like with Stanley's Ghost, that's for like 4 to 8 year olds, but it doesn't make the adult who has to read them 100 times puke. We really wanted that Disney-esque look, so it was engaging. I think sometimes people don't try hard enough when they think it's just a kid's book. I have that for each age group. You know, when you go to things like Grimmstown, the 8 to 12 year olds, they can handle a little more scare, a little more challenge to deal with.
A little more action, yeah.
Well, yeah, and also the issues that are bothering them, which is separation, anxiety, how to feel empowered, that kind of thing. So it's like a retelling of Hansel and Gretel with a booger troll, because who doesn't love a booger troll? And
spoiler alert, there's a booger troll in it. I was trying not to give too much away here, Sandy. But you touched on something really interesting. I think that kind of separation anxiety exists in a lot of the stories I've read, you know, and be it told on adult levels or for younger readers, that idea of being taken away from things that are close to you and being removed from the world and what that does to you. I wonder if that's something you seek out in these writers, or if that's just something that they bring to you in terms of sensibility, because I do think it's this thing that makes the company and its sensibility unique.
I think that, you know, most of the writers bring me, I tell them to bring me 3 concepts. And that's where we start.
Why 3 concepts?
Find one I like. or which one, you know, speaks the most to who we are. Which do I think are the most challenging, or that someone else isn't doing one like? You know, I don't want to have 4 books going at the same time that are haunted houses or gravediggers or whatever. I try and shake it up. But I think that on each level, we have different things that scare us in different ways. But you're right. There is that sense of loss of self. Who are we? As we go to the adult comics, the regular Storm King comics, they're more existential in that approach, because as adults, we start fearing different things. But it does go back to the same thing of are you lost? Have you lost your parents? Have you lost your dog? Are you simply lost in the forest? Who's going to find you? To what happens after death? What happens if you're incapacitated? Because we all fear the same things. Dismemberment, death, loss of a loved one. And so those things, horror's an allegorical way of storytelling. And so that's what I look for.
This is really interesting. At some point, it's about the thing of what's when you have everything that's familiar taken away from you.
Yeah.
And I thought that's a really interesting sort of ethos to apply to storytelling. And it's like writ large and writ small, and sometimes it's played for both comedy and horror at the same times. But also then, and again, like going back to buried deep, it's what feels like a kind of heartbreak until you peel back the onion and see, oh, there's more to this story. In fact, we get it at the very beginning. the story you wrote, that starts with a funeral, and people think one thing about a mourner and her boyfriend. And in fact, there's more to that story. And we find there's generations of mourners. In fact, that story could have been called Bad Choices.
Yeah, but on whose part, the men or the women?
I'll leave that to the eye of the beholder and clearly the writer, who is you. But I wonder where that story came from for you, because even that fits into this sensibility we're talking about.
I just thought it was funny. paybacks are a bitch.
Again, but it feels like it's supposed to be tragic at the outset. I guess it is tragic at the outset. But then there's more to it than that. And that's what's fun about these stories, too, is that they feel like there's almost kind of a shell game. They feel like they're one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And halfway into it, you realize it's something else entirely. And that's something that you get from the writers as well? Or is that something they bring to you?
You notice I have a lot of repeat writers, and they do get me. But I think that, particularly in the Halloween Nights anthologies, we've only got 13 pages or less to tell a tale that grabs you, hooks you, and then releases you. So that's a real economy of storytelling. So you've only got so long to do something, twist it around, and knock someone over the head with it.
As often as not, especially reading horror comics, they want to like scare you right away. And I want to have you talk about that, because I think that's an interesting way to sort of drive people. We go to Redhead. As these horrible things are happening, there's still not fear so much as wanting to know why. And that happens a lot, too. There's that question, why is this happening, rather than, oh, I'm scared. And then in the sort of trying to look for the answer, that's when the scares really start to ratchet up, at least for me.
I think it's more intriguing. But also, Dwayne Szczesny is a fabulous constructionist. You know, he writes novels, he writes true stories, he writes every kind of thing you can write. He writes screenplays. He's great at construction. And so he knows how to draw you in and then spring the trap, which I find the most fascinating. I look for that in the guys that are writing the graphic novels. You know, how can you take people on this journey and not just assault them all the way? Because that you get dulled out. How can you push and pull the dynamics of the journey? And so people like him and like David J. Scow, some of those guys who write both, who write screenplays, novels, and I dragged Scow into comics. And Swierczynski,
really?
Who's a buddy of his,
okay,
said, okay, I'll handhold you and show you how the page turns work and stuff. You know, it was hysterical. We basically shanghaied him in my office and said, okay, so you're going to do this and you're going to learn to like it. And now we can't stop him.
Well, is that part of it too, though, getting people who master their discipline, so you know they're storytellers, they just have to find a way to bring their particular talent and points of view to comics? Is that an easier move to make?
I'm always trying to trick people into doing it. You know, if you find a great storyteller and you know it's harder than hell to go into comics because it's a whole different discipline, but it's a really cool one to learn because it makes your other writing better. You learn economy. You learn this discipline where you've only got, say, in a regular floppy comic, you've only got 22 pages to tell the story and to have cliffhangers and to have these page turns and to do all that and still thrill.
It's funny, as you're talking about that, I always find myself thinking about 13 Horsemen, which is really, I mean, it's so spare it could be Leone. Or vampires.
Isn't he great?
Yes. And it's that same kind of thing where the story isn't set up in these conventional ways. And I just wonder if part of what it is these writers are bringing to this is just doing away with saying, this is how it starts, and just sort of jumping into it. Because again, if you jump right into it, which is something comics don't often do, it's about the why. People want, why is this stuff, not even what's going on, but why is it happening? Which is an interesting question to bring to comic storytelling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fun. And he's generally, Nat's generally a...
Nat Jones, yeah.
An artist. But comic artists are 50% of the storytelling because they're setting up the panels and they're setting up how this story moves. And when he brought 13 Horsemen in, I kind of went, wow, that's a really cool deal. I felt he'd just do something really interesting with it.
Again, the further this goes, Sandy, the more you're proving you're not an idiot. It's the treatment. My guest, the award-winning founder of Storm King Comics, is Sandy King Carpenter. You can also see the show, KCRW.com. But let's talk about this. Now that it's a thriving enterprise, what kind of interest are you getting from production companies now? I mean, for people to give you guys money to make films and TV shows out of this stuff.
Well, we need to get a bigger throw in worldwide distribution for them to really perk up. I mean, we've had a lot of interest in the anthology and the Tales for a Halloween Night, which I think is largely due to the title and John's name attached.
I was going to say, John Carpenter's Tales.
Yeah. I happen to think they should be choosing, like, Vortex by Mike Sizemore and I. because it's me. It's all about me.
But that's another one. That's Deceptive 2. Vortex is another one. You think you're getting one thing and you're getting something else. I mean, as often as not, Sandy, these stories are about this is the story. Oh, there's more of it. Wait, there's more of the story. There's more of the story. I mean, were you a reader of comics before you started to do this? Did you pay much attention to them?
I read some comics. You know, I had certain comics, you know, usually stuff by Image and things that drew me in. I wasn't a comic reader as a kid. I lived in remote places that weren't by the Five and Dime and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And then the comics that people threw at me, like Little Lulu, made me vomit. Yeah. I like the guys' comics more. I just wasn't that kind of kid.
Fair enough.
But I liked, from the age of 10 on, I liked horror books.
Which horror books do you remember?
Frankenstein, okay. Dracula, okay. Island of Dr. Moreau. I just ate them all up. So I loved the story on the surface, and I loved what they meant to me underneath.
Those also stories, too. It's funny, especially Dr. Moreau, where it feels like it's one thing and becomes something else. I wonder if in some ways what you're doing in these stories is attractive to people who are looking to get rights to intellectual property just because it is different. I mean, these aren't the standard superhero stories that people turn to comics for, or even the Stephen King adaptations. These are very different, I think, in tone and tenor. And I wonder the people who find these books, if they're visibility aside, if they're responding to these things that you're putting out in the ways that you wanted them to.
Once we have a reader, they generally turn into a permanent fan. They just have to be found. And right now I'm in the middle of looking for new distribution that's better.
Is it tough to get distribution
worldwide
now? Is it hard to do
well,
that?
Well, right now, you know, there's all the Random House, Simon & Schuster tried to merge. You know, there's all those kinds of things. So about the time I find that it's a good idea to go to a new distributor, my timing's always perfect.
I don't know. You came up with this idea 10 years ago, so clearly your timing's pretty good in terms of that. But I'm old enough to come in the days you're talking about Image, where the comics shifted to direct sales to comic stores, but
right
now those don't really exist anymore. And I was wondering, I guess it's the major change now. It's Barnes & Noble or probably Amazon where people are getting their comics, or Comixology, the website.
Yeah, I left Comixology when they got bought by Amazon. And then they wanted, you know, because I've got over 100 comics out, and they wanted them all reformatted. So we left. So we're Global Comics now. We've got digital worked out a lot better with a company that has a lot more user-friendly. It's more set up like Spotify so that there's different levels, different portals that people can, instead of just going out and pirating my comics, which they're really good at doing.
Really?
Look, it's like music.
Okay.
It goes with the territory. If they can steal it, they will. But if you give them an incentive, like Spotify did, with music, I find that they're more willing to come to what they can't get anywhere else because you give them a little incentive. And I think that's the future of how you make friends with digital, and you don't deny either print or digital, and you get them to point to each other. It doesn't have to be a war between the two mediums.
As you're saying two mediums, I just found myself wondering, it's kind of a last question here. If these are properties that you want to hold on to and find financiers and make these yourselves, or do you want to like offer them up to other hands? I mean, especially given the kind of the history of Asylum where somebody should have jumped on that right away. And when you see the book, why would you not jump on this right away? If it's just smarter for you guys just to hold on to these things and try to find ways to finance them themselves, or do you trust the world at large to do right by them?
Well, with the comics, my first goal is to make the best comic possible and not worry about an ancillary market. What I really wanted with Asylum was to make a beautiful comic with the great cover, with embossing and foils and all that, that my biggest doubter in the comic world would go, huh, look at this, she's serious. Because breaking into the comic world was just as rough as if you try and go break into the movie world.
Probably rougher just because people have really fixed ideas about what comics are supposed to be in a way that they don't for movies.
And also, they'd say, oh, this is a celebrity vanity project. And it took years for me to win over the old guard. And I remember Marv Wolfson came by the booth, and he would look at the comics and walk away. And they came in, and one day he was flipping through one. He looked at me and said, nice paper. I went, yes, yes. And now we keep looking for projects to do together.
Since you brought this up, this leads me to yet another in a series of apparent last questions. If you're now starting to find you're getting those kinds of inquiries from people like Marv Wolfman, who are really centers of the mainstream comics world, who's saying, hey, I like what you guys are doing over there. Is there something I can do with you? Is that starting to happen now?
Oh, yeah. No, it's really nice. I do have old guard. I do have those artists and writers. And I survived, which was great, because I used to have, like, Neil Adams would not talk to me, would not say good morning. You know, was a complete dick when everybody got... Yeah, they're all giving him accolades, and I'm just glad he's not in the booth next to me anymore. And he told all the kids that would work for him for free, she doesn't make real comics. And I thought, you're right, I don't trace Superman. that's the only nasty thing I'll say. Because everybody else was kind to me, but damn. Every convention, you know, I'd say good morning, offer him. I always have an espresso machine in my booth. I'd always offer him a cup of coffee, and he's near at me. So, haha, I'm still here.
I think we're out of time. And on that respectful nod to the late Neil Adams, I will thank Sandy King Carpenter, the founder of the Storm King Comics line. Sandy, thanks so much for being here.
Johnny
Sandy King Carpenter. She brought the storm to comics with Storm King Comics, a publisher now in its 10th year. Creators of comics and other media tell their stories at kcrw.com/thetreatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell with The Treat. From the mind of New York Times music writer Joe Coscarelli, who recently gave us the book Rap Capital, An Atlanta Story, he takes us into another underground with his treat.
I'm Joe Coscarelli, and this is The Treat. To me, one of the most impactful pieces of art in my life is the documentary film Dig from 2004. This is a movie by Andy Timoner, who followed two bands, the Dandy Warhols and the Brian Jonestown Massacre, for 7 years as they braved the major label system and tried to make it as rock stars.
Yeah, what's wrong with it today? I used to have one too, baby. I'll come and have a look.
I found this movie when I was in high school, and I watched it over and over again, and I continue to watch it over and over again. And I think it was the first time that I really came to appreciate the fact that you didn't have to be a musician, you didn't have to be a crazy genius like, you know, some of the characters in this movie to make impactful work about creative fields and about music specifically.
Oh yeah, that's so cool. You're gonna like sit there and hide in the darkness and throw fruit at me? Seriously, no, don't hide in the back and throw fruit when we're trying to play music, okay?
I think the immersiveness of this film, I think it was the first time that I realized, like, I don't have to be up on stage, which was never going to happen for me anyway, but I could be behind the camera. I could be behind the recorder.
Under the local Communist Party's headquarters, the band played for an audience of 10 and performed for almost as many hours.
A movie like this just really it set the tone for everything that I've wanted to do in my journalistic career, which is find interesting characters, spend a lot of time with them, and really immerse yourself in their lives and in their creative practice.
People feel if you don't want to listen to other people's opinions, then go off and do it yourself and be loved by your self, and nobody will love you because you don't want to deal with other people.
Cool, and I won't have any headaches either.
Well, great.
I don't do anything wrong. That's why I don't say I'm sorry.
To me, it's a companion piece to another one of my favorite documentaries, Hoop Dreams, which I think functions along very similar lines, which is a lot of investment in people who are not necessarily famous, not necessarily the biggest names, but people through whom you tell a specific story and get at some universal truths. So Dig, to me, extremely influential, one of my favorite films, and probably the only documentary about two obscure Northwest American bands that spawned a episode of Gilmore Girls. So Dig, I think, works on a lot of levels.
Treat the documentary Dig from Rap Capital and Atlanta Story author Joe Coscarelli, who also writes on music for the New York Times. Past treats from music writers such as Nabil Ayer are available at kcrw.com/thetreat. The Treat informs us of the inciting touchstones in the creative lives of artists from all endeavors, from the keyboard to the keyboards, and the influential moment in the forming of their sensibilities. Rebecca Mooney produces and edits this show. Katie Gilchrist mixes. Help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Kandarajan. I'm Elvis Mitchell. To better days, everyone. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.